Here's a good table quiz question. What do Pope Benedict, Les Dawson and James Joyce have in common? The answer is that these unlikely bedfellows share the same birthday, February the 2nd. For a man of letters, Joyce was, surprisingly, highly superstitious. He kept vigil the night of his mother's death, expecting to see her ghost. He also had an almost primeval fear of thunder, having been instructed by Dante Conway, his governess, that it was a warning from God to be always prepared for death. Even in later life, he trembled at the sound. Once, when asked why, he replied to his questioner, "You were not brought up in Catholic Ireland." His superstitions extended to a strong belief in the significance of dates and historical coincidences. The best-known example is, of course, his placing of the entire action of Ulysses on the 16th of June 1904, the day of his first date with his life partner, Nora Barnacle. However, never far from his thoughts was the date of his own birthday. In 1902, Joyce left Dublin for Paris, ostensibly to study medicine. In reality, he was setting off to test himself as an artist, and his time there was spent in privation. For his 21st birthday, he'd been expecting to receive money from his spendthrift father and was not amused when he only received some cards. However, he still managed to treat himself to a visit to the theatre. During the following years, he experienced apparently insurmountable problems getting his short story collection, Dubliners, published. So he regarded it as a lucky omen when his patron and publisher, Harriet Weaver, decided to begin publishing a portrait of the artist as a young man on his 32nd birthday in 1914. By now, Joyce was living in Trieste and about to start on Ulysses. As with all Irish citizens at the time, he held a British passport, and when World War I broke out, he relocated to Zurich in neutral Switzerland. After the Treaty of Versailles was signed, he moved to Paris, where he completed his novel 7 years after putting pen to paper. Still deeply attached to his belief in coincidences, he wanted the publication of his masterpiece to occur on his next birthday, his 40th. This placed a well-nigh impossible task on his publisher Sylvia Beach of Shakespeare and Company, as Joyce kept making amendments to each printer's proof as they became available. He also insisted that the colour on the front cover be the cobalt blue of the Greek national flag. And even 4 days before his birthday, he was still arguing about the precise shade of dye to be used. His final draft arrived at the Dijon-based printers with 2 days to spare. By now, he was, in his own words, in a state of energetic prostration. To meet his birthday deadline, two copies were printed the following day and rushed overnight on the Dijon-Paris Express, where they were collected at 7 a.m. from the conductor by Miss Beach. She presented Joyce with one and placed the other in the window of her bookstore. That evening, he celebrated his birthday over dinner with friends in Ferraris. He ate nothing and sat with his unwrapped present under his chair until after dessert. Then, to generous toasts, he opened the package containing the novel which would come to be seen as a masterpiece of modernist literature. Ever true to his fixation with significant dates, Joyce wanted the publication of his final major work, or monster as he called it, Finnegan's Wake, to be published on his 57th birthday. He had spent 16 years writing it. The publishers, Faber and Faber, made sure a copy arrived on time. For Joyce's birthday party of family and close friends, his daughter-in-law Helen Fleischmann arranged the table to represent France and Ireland, with a glass decanter shaped like the Eiffel Tower at one end and a glass bottle to represent Nelson's Pillar at the other. A mirror down the centre of the table served as the English Channel. She also ordered a special birthday cake with copies of his 7 books etched out in icing on the top. The party was a great success and featured piano playing, much singing, and the reading of the final pages of the work. Everyone departed in high spirits, none more so than the painter Frank Budgeon, a confidant of Joyce since their Zurich days. "Lots of fun," he called to Joyce as he left. "Lots of fun at Finnegan's Wake."
Tim Finnegan lived in Walker Street, an Irish gentleman and mighty odd. He'd a beautiful brogue so rich and sweet, and to rise in the world he carried the hod.
The guidebook had suggested a walk across the Queensbury Bridge, also known as the 59th Street Bridge, as an alternative to the more touristy Brooklyn Bridge. Since I'd already done the Brooklyn Bridge a number of times, I thought, what have I got to lose? Well, nothing, as it turned out, apart from a few long-cherished illusions. The Queensbury Bridge of my imagination had always been a gossamer-light structure, held together by nothing more than a delicate latticework of dreams, hopes, and cultural references. This misapprehension can be traced back to two main sources, The Great Gatsby and The Great Paul Simon. In F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, Jay Gatsby and Nick Carraway speed towards Manhattan in Gatsby's gleaming Rolls-Royce. As they cross the East River, Carraway notes how the city seen from the Queensbury Bridge is always the city seen for the first time, in its first wild promise of all the mystery and the beauty in the world. I had naively assumed that any bridge that grants access to mystery and beauty must itself be mysterious and beautiful. However, as I stood at the Manhattan side of the Queensbury Bridge on a cold and windy afternoon a couple of weeks ago, mystery and beauty were not much in evidence. As you approach on foot from 60th Street, your first impression of the bridge is of a traffic-choked motorway. Five lanes of traffic descend the ramp from the bridge to join the six lanes on 2nd Avenue. Sirens wail and horns blast. Amid the chaos, it's hard to sense any of the buoyant optimism that accompanied Gatsby and Nick on their way to lunch on 42nd Street. And the area certainly seems to share nothing of the carefree atmosphere conjured up by Paul Simon in his Hymn of Praise to Youth, the 59th Street Bridge Song. Kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Nowhere could I spot a single cobblestone, or anyone who was obviously looking for fun. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready to sleep. Nowhere could I see anyone who looked remotely dappled or drowsy. Instead, an elderly man was actually asleep in a doorway, his shopping trolley piled high with plastic sacks beside him. However, I decided to persist with my plan, found the pedestrian entrance to the bridge, and began the crossing. I quickly discovered that the guidebook had neglected to mention one important detail. Whereas pedestrians on the Brooklyn Bridge use a walkway elevated above the traffic, those on the 59th Street Bridge walk alongside the traffic. Juggernauts thundered past me, just a few feet away, shattering whatever remained of my good spirits and my illusions. After about 10 minutes, I decided to cut my losses and turned back, disappointed. But one further disappointment lay ahead. Near the corner of 60th Street, a young man was setting up an expensive camera on a tripod. I stopped to admire the array of lenses in the case at his feet. He was taking photographs of the bridge as part of a college assignment, he told me. I told him I'd been lured up to have a look at the bridge because of the song. What song is that? He asked politely. You know, I replied, the 59th Street Bridge song. He looked at me uncomprehendingly. You know, the Simon and Garfunkel song? He continued to look at me blankly. Paul Simon? An Art Garfunkel? Bridge Over Troubled Waters? I'm sorry, he said. I've never heard of those people. His face was starting to take on the panicked expression of someone who has just realised they've been ambushed into conversation. by a slightly crazed older person, and that there might not be any escape route. I began to feel sorry for him, but not as sorry as I was beginning to feel for myself. There I was, with my ridiculous notions about the bridge and my outmoded cultural references, expecting this youngster to understand what I was on about. So this is what old age feels like, I thought. Once again, I decided to cut my losses. Right, well, anyway, good luck with the photographs, I said, and moved off. Although the word groovy has never really been part of my vocabulary, I now knew what it was to feel distinctly ungroovy. Minutes later, back in the 59th Street subway station, I noticed that the walls along the platform have the station name written in beautiful mosaic tiles of blue, white and gold. As I was taking my camera out to photograph them, a passing subway employee stopped, a young man not much older than the photographer I'd just spoken to. "You like those tiles?" he asked. "If you like those, you'll love the ones over the other side, under Bloomingdale's." I told him I'd leave that for another day. I was heading downtown. He jerked his thumb towards the station sign. "You know that song, don't you? Feeling Groovy? Great song." I nodded and smiled. He'd saved the day.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down on the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling proud.
It fell out of the book as I opened it, a postcard in a kind of virulent liverish pink, the message written in a brownish ink, maybe faded, maybe that colour originally. The message covers both sides of the card, the writing beginning in a large, somewhat childish scrawl and developing into a more adult, slightly spiky form. In ink, mind you, not ballpoint. Given the novel's title and notoriety, the writer is, most probably, an adult. That's often the case with second-hand books. You get more than you actually pay for. But in this case, I suppose, anything extra would be welcome, because I'd just paid €65, inscribed in pencil on the flyleaf, for an unlimited edition of a novel, the first unlimited edition from 1937, and from the Pitman Press in Bath, for John Lane, the Bodley Head, of 28 Little Russell Street in London. The original price doesn't appear on the dust jacket, but my guess would be around 3 and 6 pence. Not been good at the maths, I'm not sure what the €65 represents in inflation, but it's hefty. But for me, worth it, despite the purchase being merely a replacement for the original copy of the book that I'd owned. And of course, it's a novel that is still in print. But somehow, my bibliophile soul rebelled at the thought of a shiny new paperback edition as something that should be a valued long-time possession and companion. Hence, my trek up several floors in Kenny's bookshop in Galway to the section devoted to rare and antiquarian books. That was before they moved to a suburban industrial estate. I emerged, as I say, triumphant, my replacement under my arm. I had a fair idea where my original copy had gone. I knew there was no hope of ever getting it back, its disappearance matched to the separate loss of 2 volumes of what had been a complete set of the Henry Irving Shakespeare, illustrated and utterly delightful, and probably quite valuable, if complete and unbroken, as it had been when in my possession. Anyway, my new purchase was a slightly earlier edition than my original copy, so I didn't feel too badly scalped. Back to the liverish, undated postcard that fell from between pages 550 and 551. It was clear that the writer was feeling liverish as well. In case I don't see you to thank you for letting me pinch this from your bookcase, herewith a brief note. Well, at least the writer had the grace to return the pinched object. And he continues, "I ploughed through this book, understanding about a quarter," written in figures, Of this quarter, I found some lovely bits, Irish and new. Others were smutty enough to need a wipe. It's a very long, strange book, and I'm afraid I missed a lot owing to being very badly read. Thank you, too, for the nice evening. I was most impressed by your house and thought it looked very pretty. Poor Sally, I hope she'll be back around the hearth soon. One wonders how gratified the host was to receive this supposed compliment, and one wonders if Sally might have absented herself from the dinner table with a dose of diplomatic flu. There was a strong implication, I thought, that the writer rather felt that the inclusion of the book in question in the bookcase was somewhere between a lapse in taste and a stain on the purity of the decor. Somehow, one suspects, the guest might have been seriously out of tune with his hosts, both the present and the absent halves. But what was this overlong piece of somewhat dense smut? Are you with me? Maybe the publisher I mentioned gives a clue. Hardly famed for producing pornography in any sense of the term, not even for smut, which is a fairly demeaning term, suggesting that the subject should be dismissed by any discerning reader with moral standards. Alas, no. The publication to arouse such highbrow, pseudo-self-deprecating criticism was Ulysses. It's easy to imagine the writer's mouth tightening along with his penmanship as he struggled to appear above it all, composing his required bread-and-butter letter after being entertained to dinner. He was not remotely shocked, his host was given to understand, but merely an arbiter of decency and standards. Badly read, as he points out, meaning, one guesses, badly read in distasteful drivel that is beneath genuine literary contempt. I can imagine the recipient of this missive sighing with a combination of despair and glee as he tucked it into the pages of his returned Ulysses as a marker for future generations of reading public. Or maybe as a reminder to show to the returned Sally at the hearth. I would love to know how the book passed from his and Sally's hands onto the shelves of Kenny's bookshop and thus into my possession to ensure a new round of glee as it fell into my receptive lap in a new century.
Being a member of a choir can land you in strange places. Some time ago, our choir could be heard singing Ubi Caritas, all 40 of us, packed into the Galerus Oratory near Dingle in County Kerry. Likewise, in a stone church on Omi Island, we sang Bruckner's Locus Iste. On another occasion, we clambered onto the plinth below a statue of a certain composer in the small town of Palestrina, outside Rome, in order to serenade Giovanni Perluigi da Palestrina with one of his own works. I remember with particular fondness the time we were invited to perform in Gloucester House, County Offaly. We were not the first voices to reverberate around this magnificent 18th century house. Dame Nellie Melba, the Australian soprano, visited Gloucester in the early part of the 20th century. I stood in the front hall looking at the balcony where she had performed and imagined the dame singing arias for invited guests from the nearby town of Birr. Nellie Melba was born Helen Porter Mitchell in Australia on the 19th of May 1861. She created her stage name from her native city of Melbourne. She married Charles Armstrong and they had one son, but motherhood and domesticity did not suit Melba, and she abandoned her family in favour of her career. Her music took her to Europe, where she trained in Paris and was soon to become the prima donna at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, London, a status she enjoyed from the early 1900s. Despite the angelic voice for which she was admired, she was also known for her demanding diva persona. Often she would make last-minute changes before a performance, and she was intolerant of rivals. John McCormack, on the night of his London debut, attempted to take a bow with her on stage, but she pushed him back forcefully, saying, "No one takes a bow with Melba." Dame Melba, who gave command performances before crowned heads of Europe, had a scandalous affair with Philippe, the Duke of Orléans, and, it is said, paraded herself endlessly in aristocratic gatherings. She had, it seemed, fallen in love with all the mannered affectations of European aristocracy. But the egocentric artiste was only one side of Melba. She was also helpful to the careers of younger singers and founded a singing school in Melbourne, providing her services free of charge. Based in Australia during the First World War, Melba worked tirelessly to raise money for war charities through her concerts. It was this work that earned her the title of Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. In the 22 years from 1904 to 1926, she was to make almost 200 recordings. Her voice was renowned for its even quality over a range of nearly three octaves and for its pure timbre. While she had her detractors, Melba also had a following of loyal fans, not least the French chef Auguste Escoffier, who created Pêche Melba and Melba Toast in her honour. A few recordings of Dame Nelly remain and are available to listen to online, specifically Caranome from Rigoletto and The Mad Scene from Lucia de Lammermoor. The clarity is understandably indistinct in these recordings from 100 years ago, and for this reason it is difficult to admire or criticise her technique. Nevertheless, there continues to be lively online discussion about her skill and personality between fans and detractors, not least when Kiri de Canua portrayed her as a charming visitor in an episode of Downton Abbey. We're not sure of the exact date of Dame Melba's visit to County Offaly, but it was probably sometime after 1903 when the then owner of Gloucester House, John Hardress Lloyd, married an Australian heiress. In her autobiography, Melba writes of singing in the open square on a drizzly afternoon at a concert in Birr. This was on a visit to her husband's relatives in Forbann, and likely the occasion of her Gloucester House performance. On my visit to Gloucester House and nearby Shinrone Church, our choir performed Vivaldi's Gloria. Thankfully, on that occasion, no one had to put up with a cantankerous diva.
It's 116 years since a young Irish couple, Jim Joyce and Nora Barnacle, travelled to Trieste, and the old city has hardly changed a whit. Trieste is surrounded by limestone hills, and the wind sweeps down and blows across the wide piazzas. It's an elegant city, built in white stone that catches the sun, a city that faces the sea. We went there last summer on a kind of pilgrimage. Of course, they weren't meant to go there at all, Jim and Nora. Joyce thought he was travelling to a job with the Berlitz School in Zurich. He'd paid 2 guineas to a Miss Guilford of the Midland Scholastic Agency in Lincolnshire. Unfortunately, Miss Guilford was not an agent for Berlitz, and Jim was duped. I remember going to an interview in Bewley's in Westmoreland Street in 1976. I was 19 and heading off on my own for the first time. An agency was recruiting staff for pubs in London, and I paid my £20 before heading off with my bit of paper. The pub was there, okay, but they claimed never to have heard of the company who'd sent me. The manager bluntly told me I wasn't wanted, and so I left with my tail between my legs. I still blush at my naivety, but at least I'm in good company. Me and 22-year-old Jim Joyce, off like Egypts to non-existent jobs. And what of Nora, at 20 years of age, heading off to Europe, an unmarried girl who didn't speak French or Italian and who was totally dependent upon Jim to support her until she found her feet. Now there was an act of courageous faith in her young man. When they got to Zurich, to the non-existent job, Jim blagged and charmed the director of the Berlitz School, who found a position for him in Trieste, and the company paid their fares. Now that's impressive blagging. Except when they got to Trieste, there was no vacancy, and so off they headed again, this time on a steamer at the company's expense, 150 miles south to Pola on the Dalmatian coast, where Berlitz was opening a new school. At Easter the following year, 1905, Jim got a transfer to the school in Trieste, and this elegant city became the couple's home for more than a decade. Jim and Nora loved Trieste, with its opera house, its fountains, its wide squares, its outdoor cafes, and its cosmopolitan glamour. Part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it attracted the best opera singers as they moved between Milan and Vienna. In the narrow Via San Nicola, standing outside the apartment where Jim and Nora lived and where Giorgio, their son, was born, I feel the hair stand on the back of my neck. From there, we stroll around the adjoining streets and try to find some of the other 8 addresses where the signor and signora lived. Later, I have my photo taken with the life-size statue of Joyce crossing the bridge over the Grand Canal in the Piazza Pontarosso, one of their favourite places in the city. And as I pose with my arm around his shoulder and look towards the sea, I marvel at my companion and feel as close to Jim Joyce as if he were living and breathing beside me. The Joyces, as they were known, moved often in Trieste, always one step ahead or behind financial ruin. But Jim and Nora had a knack of finding cheap rooms or bad rooms in great locations and used the city as their drawing room. All the addresses are clustered around the best and smartest part of town, close to the shops, cafes, theatres, piazzas, and the seafront. They might have led a hand-to-mouth existence, but they lived with style and flair. They enjoyed city life. They attended the opera and dined out. And when the money ran out, Jim scrounged, with great success, from all and sundry. And Nora did her bit too. 3 weeks after the birth of Giorgio, she took in washing to supplement their meagre earnings, all the while fuming that Jim wouldn't use his beautiful voice in that city of song to earn a little more. My beloved and I take coffee in the Opera House Cafe, where Jim and Nora like to sit. The sun bathes the square and the breeze carries the sea air. We smile at each other across the table, as lovers do. Here, more than 100 years ago, James Joyce sat, a young 20-something with big ideas and a walking stick, dreaming of forging the uncreated conscience of his race, writing stories of Dublin with not a bob in his pocket. You'd have to love him, this young Jim Joyce, as Nora did. Blagger, poser, scrounger, jealous lover, young fella with an unshakable faith in his own talent. We sit there and soak up the atmosphere, and then we raise a glass in memory and in honour. Here's to you, Jim Joyce, writer, genius, lover of Trieste.
La ci darem la mano, la mi dirai di sì. Vedi, non è lontano, partiam ben mio da...
Antidote. Because wind, because rain, because skin over bone, because night worn thin, because web, because fabric, because blanket, because patchwork quilt, because stitch, 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 because love, because story, because linked arms, stout legs, because holding, because held, because graveyards so full, because with us forever, because we will not forget, because human bridge, because love, because story.
On this morning's programme, we heard James Joyce's Birthday by Jerry Maloney, The 59th Street Bridge, Feelin' Ungroovy by Conal Hamill, Ulysses was by Emer O'Kelly, Peach Melba by Nollaig Rowan. Here's to you, Jim Joyce. Saluting James Joyce in Trieste was by Kevin McDermott. And finally, Antidote, a poem by Geraldine Mitchell. The music on the programme was Finnegan's Wake, sung by Barry Gleason, The 59th Street Bridge Song, Feelin' Groovy by Simon and Garfunkel, Love's Old Sweet Song, sung by Thomas Allen with Malcolm Martineau on piano, Caro Nome from Rigoletto by Verdi, sung by Dame Nellie Melba in a recording that was made in 1904, and La Ti Darem La Mano from Don Giovanni by Mozart, sung by Cecilia Bartoli with Bryn Terfel and the Orchestra dell'Accademia Nazionale di Santa Cecilia, conducted by Myung Won Chung.